This is Life in the Passing Lane, an autobiography by me. I'm Alex Bennett. This chapter is entitled Live 105 Stories. Best title I could come up with. What I just want to do is talk primarily about Live 105 and my time at Live 105. It became Live 105 after about a year and a half of being Kit's Hot Hits, and it was a good idea because it changed the music they played and the approach that it was taking and became an extremely very popular radio station because of it. And my place in it was I set the table. I did the morning show. And that's what a morning show always does. It sets the table for the rest of the day. And while my program really didn't concern itself with playing music, although we did play some, it didn't really care that much about music as it did about, I guess, the culture behind what we were playing. In other words, if in fact we were playing a kind of music that evoked at that time a progressive rock, modern rock as we tended to call it, then my show was kind of the embodiment verbally of what we were playing. So it was a very nice fit and a very good fit and a fit that lasted for quite a while. My day at Live 105 always started at 5 o'clock in the morning. That's when the alarm rang. Now the show went on from 6 to 10. So you're saying, gee, why didn't you get up at 4? Why didn't you get up at 3? Because I detest getting up at 3 or 4 in the morning. And so I would go to bed every night about 11 o'clock. I would sleep until 5. That was 6 hours of sleep. And we'll explain where I got the rest of my sleep a little bit later. But I would get up, and the night before, I would have taken a shower. I would have shaved. I would have done all those things before I went to bed so that all I had to do was to, as I used to say, check on the floor to see what clothes were there, and if they smelled good, I put them on. But, you know, because my show had a studio audience, I couldn't be like a lot of other people. You know, most people who do radio programs don't shave. They don't really care what they're wearing, especially if you're doing a morning show because you're out of there before anybody else really shows up. Overnight people, those people could work in the nude if they wanted to, and nobody would know the difference. It's radio. But I had saddled myself with a live studio audience, so I couldn't exactly look the pig every day, okay? I had to look okay. And so I did my best to kind of make sure that the clothes that were lying on the floor that night were the ones I wanted to wear the next day. And, you know, I'd grab a t-shirt and put that on and some kind of jacket. And off I would go down to my basement where the garage was. And I would take one of my two cars out. I had two cars. Actually, one of them, after a while, I didn't keep in San Francisco. I kept it in my business manager's place. But I had had a sports car, which was a Nissan 300Z, okay. And then I had gotten a little later on, I leased an Acura and a beautiful car. It was like driving around in the living room. And that's the one I usually took to work with me. And I would drive down through Chinatown. And the trip between my place and the studio was, I think I had it timed at about 20 minutes, okay? Because there was no traffic that time in the morning or whatever. But if I was getting late, I would call the radio station and I would say, play an extra record or put on another song. Or if I was really late, like let's say I overslept, which very rarely ever happened, I would actually start the show from my cell phone while I was driving to work. In any event, it was everything I hated about getting up to go to work that time of the morning. But yet, doing a morning show is probably the most important single day part for a radio station. As I said, it sets the table for the rest of the day. Your morning show can get the largest audience. Your morning show can make the most money for a radio station. And so the morning show is very important. Now, I could say, okay, but I only want to do the afternoon show. Well, then they wouldn't make me the star I wanted to be. And I could say, I want to work overnight, and they wouldn't care about me or even know my name. But if I'm the morning show and I'm making the money, I get all the benefits from that. I get the good salary. I get the all the perks that go along with the job. I get a large staff to help me do the show, which grew and grew and grew. Because when I first started, it was just me and a producer and a newswoman. And by the time we were through, I think I checked it out, we had something like 9 or 10 people working my show. And not one of them was like a writer or anything like that. We had like a producer, we had a doorman, we had an engineer who would engineer the music segments. And I mean, on and on and on. Anyway. I would get in the car, I would drive down, and I would drive to the radio station and pull into its garage in the basement, and then I would take the elevator from the basement all the way up to, I think we were on maybe the 3rd or 4th floor, I can't remember right now. And this was in the new studio that I'm talking about. Prior to that, we had been in the old studios. The old studio was in the Furniture Mart, which now, by the way, I am told is... It's not Google, it's, I can't remember. One of the other big major social deals. Oh, it's Twitter. We had that studio was very small. And the audience really was kind of like a small, like 8-10 people maybe could sit in the studio. And then people would sit outside the studio and watch it. Some people would stand over to the side. But we were in that studio for quite a while. But finally, they got this new building, and that's the one I'm talking about. And I would go up to the 3rd floor or whatever the floor it was on. Might have been the 2nd. I can't remember. These are things you forget when you get older because they weren't important in the first place. You just knew what button to push at the time. And I would go up to the studio, and there it was. And the studio was kind of built for me. In fact, it wasn't kind of built for me. It was built for me. It was built for my needs, and my needs were I wanted a live studio audience. So we had chairs lined up against one side of the wall, chairs on the other side, another side facing me. And that would hold about maybe, I think we could hold, and if we sometimes doubled the chairs over and stuff, we could hold about 15, 20 people in that studio, some of them standing. But then what we had was a big window that opened up. And then we had like 30, 40 chairs piled back in the 2nd room. But when the window was open, it was like they were part of the same room. And that's where we put the overflow who wanted to see the show. And some days the overflow was huge. I think the show that we actually had the most people show up for was one day when I had Tori Amos on, who has these fans who just adore her, okay? And Jackie Chan. Both of these were all on the same show, okay? And we announced ahead of time, I had tomorrow, Jackie Chan, Tori Amos. I show up to the studio. Downstairs, there was a line going almost all the way around the block. We're never going to be able to get all these people in. And when I walk into the studio, it is just jammed packed. And it's going all the way out to the lobby. Okay? And by the way, Tori Amos wasn't going to just do an interview. She was going to perform as well. And that's the day I remember of us getting the largest live studio audience that we had ever had at that station. And what would happen is the first hour of the show would be usually just me and Lori and Chuck Farnham, who was one of the sidekicks. He was a kind of our stunt guy. He would go out and do all the dirty things, you know, put peanut butter all over himself and walk down the street as a giant peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I mean, he would do weird stuff. And sometimes people would talk with us who were just working, the overnight people, or some guy who was doing some stuff in another room might jump in, and we'd just all talk. In fact, one of the people that was a regular, because he was the overnight guy, was Carson Daly. And Carson would always do the show whenever he could. He would come in after he was through with his show, and we would just sit around. He'd be part of the mix, too. So that went on for a while with him, but then he got really the job that he should have had in the first place. He went to MTV and became a VJ. But anyway, I digress. That was pretty much the show. And then in the second hour, we'd start having the comedians start dribbling in. And usually I was always happy if it was one of my regulars. I had regulars, and then there were the comedians who were coming through town. And the comedians who were the regulars were people like Larry Bubbles Brown, who later became our traffic guy, and people like Jeremy Kramer, Stephen Pearl, David Feldman, of course, was always one of my favorites. I could go on and on. I'm probably going to leave somebody out here if I try to name them all. And then I'll have somebody mad at me. But usually, hopefully, we would have one of those people because they knew how the show went. They would come on, and I knew them, and I liked them, and they made me laugh. It was just the kind of guys that became, and women, who became the base of the show. And then there would be the comedians who were coming through town. And sometimes they were, people like George Lopez, who had come through, who I liked. I really thought was a terrific comedian at the time. And on one occasion, I believe, maybe a couple of occasions, Jay Leno came by and did the show. And, we had almost every major comedian you could think of. We had Robin Williams. I'm trying to think of people we didn't have, you know. But I think at one time or another, during the time that my show was on the air at Live 105, we had almost every major comedian of the day, plus all the up-and-comers. So a lot of those up-and-comers became big later on. Guys doing very well now. Patton Oswalt was a regular on my show. I loved having Patton on the show. He was one of those guys I looked forward to. When I knew he was going to be there, I knew we had the basis for a decent show. Okay? So anyway, that's how the whole thing ran. And then in the third hour, usually that's when the non-comedian person would come in. The movie star. The television actor, or the television comedian, or whatever, the sitcom person. In other words, and sometimes newsmakers, you know. We had Jimmy Carter on. I remember the greatest thing ever happened to me with Jimmy Carter was when he wished me a happy birthday, because he happened to call on my birthday. So, the third hour always was that interview that I always wished I could get. And we sometimes finally got them. You know, I once said, the greatest thing about doing a talk show is that you get to meet all the people you've ever wanted to meet. And you've got an excuse. Hey, I really want to meet Jerry Seinfeld. Hey, call up Seinfeld and see if he wants to do an interview for our show. And because our show was so popular in San Francisco, if you came on our show, it was gold. And then the last hour was the hour that the station kept saying, could you play a little more music? You know, I often said that radio stations treated me like a Jew that would come over to dinner, and then you would serve ham to see if you could make him eat it. And trying to get me to play music was the equivalent of trying to make a Jew eat ham. They knew I hated playing music. I hated playing music because I had a couple of things against music. Number one, I often wondered why these record companies didn't pay radio stations to play their music. Now, you say, isn't that payola? Well, payola makes a lot of sense. Let me explain this to you. Without the radio stations, the music wouldn't get exposed, at least in those days. Today, you've got the internet and, you know, iTunes and things like that. But in those days, you needed the radio stations to expose the music. And so the music people hated my show because we didn't play a lot of music, and yet we had the largest audience on the radio station. And I didn't like being what I would call the pawn of the record companies. You know, that they were playing music on my show, and then they were going to make money off that music, and the station didn't get anything back for it. That's why I've always kind of believed in payola. Hey, you want us to plug your record? You want us to play it? You're going to pay us like any advertiser would. But anyway, I digress. I just didn't like playing music. It wasn't I didn't like music. In my private life, I listened to it all the time. But it was just that I felt what I was doing was comedy. And you don't go, you know, it's hard enough to be doing comedy. Everybody's laughing and everything you say. Now we'll take out this time for a word from our sponsors. All right. And then there's like a 4 minute break and then you're back to the hilarity for another 10 minutes till there's another break for commercials. Add to that music breaks. And before you know it, you know, you can't get any momentum going on the show. So that's why I didn't like playing music a lot. Now, let me talk to you about something else that we did on that morning show, which was kind of interesting. It was the ability to travel. And at least once a year or so, we would travel to some other city to do the show. Most of the time, it was New York City. And we used the ABC studios here in New York. We used the CBS studios here in New York. And we would come to New York. We also went to, Los Angeles as well. Used the studios out of Los Angeles for ABC. Somehow they had the best satellite. I don't know why. But anyway, we would go somewhere else other than San Francisco to do the show for a week. Just, you know, why not? When we went to New York, we could get people that were in New York. I would have never been able to have Dan Rather on the show or... any of like the talk show hosts and so on who work out of New York in San Francisco. I could do them by phone, but I couldn't have them in the studio with me. So going on these little trips were great. Another trip, though, that used to happen for us, and this was a amazing kind of trip, were the Coca-Cola trips. Okay, let me explain these to you. Coca-Cola, I guess as far back as anybody can remember, was a sponsor of the Olympics. I think when the first modern Olympics started, I think within a few years, Coca-Cola was there advertising, passing out Coca-Cola, a really healthy product, by the way, for an avid sportsman. They were big promoters of it. And so what they did is they started saying, okay, let's take all these morning show hosts around the country, offer them a free trip along with their, you know, their news person and maybe their producer to go to the Olympics for 3 days, because the Olympics are 2 weeks, but for 3 days, and we will have studios there for them to use and to do their shows from the Olympics, courtesy of, and you guessed it, Coca-Cola, who got some free advertising for all of this, but we didn't mind. They were picking up the tickets. They were picking up the lodging and all of that. And one of the nicest pieces of lodging we ever had was the first one we went to. We went to the Olympics, Winter Olympics in Albertville. Now, you got to remember, when you're doing the Winter Olympics, they say it's in Albertville, but only the stadium is in Albertville. The rest of the Olympics take place in almost 100 square mile area around that venue. The same thing was true later on when we went to Lillehammer. That's the way the Winter Olympics ran. So they put us up about 25 miles away, 30 miles away, up in the mountains in a place called Kirchhoffel. And Kirchhoffel was a ski destination, one of the biggest skiing areas in the world. Just supposedly beautiful skiing there. I don't know. I don't ski. But they put us up in a chalet. And I mean, it was... What happens is when they would go into a town and they would do the Olympics, all the people who lived there moved out during the Olympics. They didn't want to be there. I mean, the town was going to be a mess. So they would rent out their places. And I don't know who owned this chalet, but this thing was palatial. And it was wonderful. And there was snow everywhere. And it was the chalet. And it was just wonderful. And I was bunking with Bobby Slayton, who we brought with us. And, you know, he's looking out the window going, ah, look at all that fucking snow. Have you ever seen such a messy thing in your life? You know, and there's just this beautiful, beautiful scenery. And it's just gorgeous. But we went to Albertville. And then we went to Barcelona for the Summer Olympics. And Barcelona was another treat for me because I had been to Barcelona before, but not when it was a very good town to go to. Here's the reason why. In the days when Franco was still alive, he hated the Basques. And the Basque separatists, their home was Barcelona. So he constantly tried to starve out Barcelona and wouldn't fix up the town. And so when you went into Barcelona in those days, it was like a gray, impoverished city. So I didn't know what to expect. By this time, he had died. They had had some time to get ready for the Olympics. And when I showed up at Barcelona, I saw one of the great world cities. I mean, all the fountains were working, all the buildings were painted, everybody was happy, there was joy in the streets. I mean, what a wonderful town. And it was in Barcelona that two things happened that were wonderful. Number one, on the first night, they said, Coca-Cola is presenting a concert at the Mini Stadium. Mini Stadium, 70,000 people can fit in a mini stadium. And they said, we're presenting a concert, and we have tickets for you. Would you like to go? Well, who's the performer? Elton John. Now, that concert is was on LaserDisc at one time, and I think it's still available, like on DVDs or whatever. It was one of the greatest concerts I've ever been to in my life, and it was a beautiful night. And up on the hill is this church, and you could, that was kind of looking down. That was the background for this mini stadium, and it was just, I just remember it as being one of the greatest moments of my life. And I even reminded Elton John when we were introduced to him. I said, "Elton, you do know that I did the first interview you ever did in the United States." And he said, "Oh, where?" And I said, "At WMCA in New York. I'm Alex Bennett." And he went, "Don't remember it." So anyway, you know, but the other great thing about Barcelona was one day we went up to where the church was and took the tram up there, and I'm videotaping like crazy, and all of a sudden, as I'm videotaping, all of a sudden I'm shooting this guy outside who later I shoot in a bar, and I must have the footage back in storage in the Bay Area. O.J. Simpson. Yeah. I hung around with O.J. for a little while. I didn't say hello to him, and he didn't say hello to me, but I got to watch him coming on to every woman that was in close proximity to him. And we were very lucky, because what happened was that last year of 1992 with the Albertville Olympics meant that 2 years later there was going to be another one. So now we were going to go to them even a little faster than we had in the past. And we went to Lillehammer. This was in 1994. Now, I got to tell you a story about this. And it was a wake-up call for me and a lesson that I learned. My newswoman and I, Lori Thompson, were very close as friends. We were close as workers. We had a lot of respect for each other. And always, like any people who work with each other, occasionally you'd have an argument here and there. All right? Well, we got to Lillehammer, and it was not under the best circumstances, because to begin with, our baggage was the last baggage to come off the plane. You know how that horrible feeling you get when the carousel goes around and around and around and around, and your particular luggage hasn't shown up. And finally, it shows up. And we grab our bags, and as we're walking out, the constables stop us. And they say, "Would you please come with us?" And I'm going, "What's this about?" They figured since we were the last ones getting off, maybe we were terrorists. I don't know what they thought, but all I know is I wound up having a rectal exam I didn't want. So now, after being terrorized at the airport by the Norwegian authorities, I'm out of it. I'm mad. I'm beside myself. I am raging about everything that's been going on, and let's do this thing, get out of this fucking country, right? Because I just didn't like the way I arrived at it. So finally we get to our place in Lillehammer. It's on the main street in Lillehammer. And I'm starting to kind of rest in a little bit. And I decide I'll go over and see Lori. And she was put up with some woman from some other radio station. And this woman was, I don't know, she was a little on the weird side, to say the least. And this woman, when I was sitting in the room, started baiting me about stuff. And I say baiting me, you know how somebody's trying to, like, get you to, like, get irritable and irritated by something they say. And she just kept up with this, and she kept up with this, and she kept up with this. And finally, I said to Lori, I can't take any more of this. I'll see you tomorrow, okay? And as I'm walking out the door, I said, Lori, would you come outside a second? I just want to talk to you for a second. And she came out, and I said, Lori, I'm really disappointed in you because you didn't, you didn't defend me to her. You know, you just let her get away with that crap. And Lori was kind of like, just kind of put off by me even bringing it up. And they got a little heated in discussion. And at one point, I started yelling at her. I said, I expect you to help me. And I've gone through all this shit already that day. And now I'm having to put up with this. And I start yelling at Lori. And at one point, I kind of slap my hands or slap my fist. And then I go, okay, well, you know, excuse me, I'm just tired, I guess, but I wish you had defended me. And she went back inside, okay? The next morning, I go into the Coca-Cola Studios, right on Lillehammer's Main Street. And they come up to me, you ready for this? Coca-Cola police. And they say, will you come with us, please? And I go, well, what for? And they went, just come with us. And they take me down into the basement, and they sit me down in a chair, and they say, stay right there. I said, why? They said, we have a report that you hit Lori Thompson last night. And I said, I would never hit Lori Thompson. They said, well, we've had a report that you had an altercation with her and that you hit her in the process. And I went, this is ridiculous. And what we're going to do is if we can't clear this thing up, we're sending you home immediately. I said, well, I don't care if I get out of this fucking country now. And I sat down there for a good hour in the possession of the Coca-Cola police. I was being detained by Coca-Cola. Are you listening to this? I still drink their products to this very day, however. And finally, Lori comes in. And they take her aside. I don't see this going on. And they said to her, did Alex hit you last night? She said, what? I said, did Alex hit you last night? And she went, Alex wouldn't hit me. He wouldn't hit anybody. He's one of the most decent people, nonviolent people I know. And they went, are you sure? And she said, of course I'm sure. Do you see any marks on me or anything like that? No, he didn't hit me. He wouldn't think of hitting me. So they came downstairs to me and they said, we apologize. Lori Thompson has vouched for you and said that you didn't hit her. All is okay. And I go, no, all isn't okay. Who the hell told you that? And it turned out it was this woman. And before you knew it, she was on a plane back to the United States. And the Coca-Cola company did everything they could to apologize because they could, you know, they smelled legal action in the wind. And it made me realize that if you're the guy in something like this, it's very hard for you to speak up for yourself because they will automatically believe the woman before they'll believe you. And I don't want to diminish women who get beaten and turn whoever it is in. But I also have to say there are women out there who, like this woman, will say something that's patently not true. And it's up to you. It's up to you to prove your innocence. And everybody's going to believe the woman before they believe you. Luckily, Lori Thompson, God bless her soul, kind of looked at him like, where are you from outer space saying Alex would hit me? And that was that. But those trips were interesting. And the last one we went to was Atlanta. Okay. But that wasn't exciting. The reason it was in Atlanta was it was the 100th anniversary of the Olympics, of the Summer Olympics. And Coca-Cola, who had been sponsoring it all those years, lobbied to have it in Atlanta. It should have been in Athens. And they gave it to Athens 4 years later, but it should have been in Athens because that's where the first one was. But no, it had to be in Atlanta. And the only thing exciting that happened there is there was a little bit of an explosion that went on at the Olympic kind of, I don't know, it was kind of like a little festival grounds or whatever. You remember that one. But outside of that, that was not really a great memorable trip because we're just going to be in the United States. What the heck? You'd think everything was hunky-dory, going around the world, meeting great people. Things were terrific at Live 105, and then all of a sudden, something happened. This has been Life in the Passing Lane, an audio biography by me. I'm Alex Bennett.